You know what you're listening to?
Is that a trick question?
It's the I Still Love This Game podcast with your host, Matthew Damien.
He's an idiot. Don't listen to this. He's an idiot.
Hello and welcome to episode 37 of the I Still Love This Game podcast. We have reached the final day of the regular season in the NBA, and I don't know where to begin. We've got so much to talk about here in terms of potential playoff seedings, which is an incredibly rare situation because you can think about all the stars that have to align for a play-in game to happen. And people like to compare this to a Game 7 situation, but it's not. Because you think about a Game 7, what does that mean? You played six games in a week and a half, maybe even longer if it's in the first round. And there's such an air of familiarity with that opposing team. There is no air of familiarity. This is one game. It's not a seventh game. This is one game. And for 82 games to come down to one game, and you have to be playing that team on the second last or the last day of the regular season, at least the last game on your schedule, as I said, all the stars have to align for this, and it's like a perfect storm. And if it sounds like I'm excited, there's plenty to be excited about because we get essentially an extra day of playoff basketball. This is a great appetizer of what we're going to get in the playoffs. And if you know anything about basketball or the NBA specifically, playoff basketball is a completely different sport to regular season basketball. It's much different intensity. It's a much more intelligent brand of basketball. And it's just a completely different beast. There's no room for errors. There's no room for weaknesses. If you have a weakness, it will be exposed and you'll be held accountable for it. In regular season basketball, you can get away with that. Some teams may be on the tail end of a seven game road trip. Some teams might be on the back end of a back-to-back or three games in four nights. And that completely levels the playing field, and that's why you see upsets in the NBA regular season. It's a level playing field in playoff basketball. You have one opponent. More often than not, home court advantage is not a factor because it doesn't go to the fifth game. Fifth game's a long goal. I don't know why I was about to mention that. But it's rare that you go to a seventh game, so many times that it's a level playing field. It's a complete level playing field despite the seeding differentials. And we'll get to that in today's show as well, but I want to begin with Denver versus Minnesota, which is the play-in game. And I mentioned before that these things are rare. There's two that come to my mind. I believe it was the 2000 season with Milwaukee and Orlando, and Milwaukee went into Orlando and beat them. That was a year that Doc Rivers was the coach of the year, I believe. And they had lost Penny Hardaway. They traded Penny Hardaway. It was essentially a rebuilding year. That's when we first started to see Ben Wallace emerge as a star player, on the defensive end at least. However, they still lost to Ray Allen and Glenn Robinson and Sam Cassell and those guys. And then in the first round of the playoffs, the Bucks very nearly knocked off the top-seeded Indiana Pacers. Speaking of Game 5, it went to a Game 5, and the Bucks were up in the final minute before Reggie Miller and Jalen Rose hit some big shots down the stretch. It really got them out of trouble, and they ended up going to the NBA Finals, where they gave the Lakers a real good run for their money. And the other one was a few years prior to that, was the Washington Bullets at that time. It was the last season that they were called the Bullets. It was before they changed the name to the Wizards because they wanted to counter inner city crime. So clearly changing the basketball team's nickname did a lot to help that out. Just look at the crime stats in the last, 20 years now? Yeah, pretty much. 97 to 2018. So just over 20 years. And so that's clearly made a big inroads. Regardless, the Cavaliers, led by Terrell Brandon, and not a whole lot else. Bobby Fields, rest in peace to him. Tyrone Hill, and I believe Wesley Person, the younger brother of Chuck Person, the Rifleman, was on that team. But they didn't have a whole lot else beyond Terrell Brandon. And they were going up against Chris Webber, Juwan Howard, George Mureson, Rod Strickland. Rod Strickland was All-NBA second team that year. So they had a pretty loaded team. It was kind of the similar situation to really when you think about the Orlando-Milwaukee game. You had a young team that essentially underachieved in the regular season and versus a team that overachieved, and the underachievers, because of their talent, were able to walk away with a victory and go into the playoffs. They faced up against the Bulls, and they really did actually challenge the Bulls in all three games. which might sound absurd, but when you go back and watch those games, they tested Jordan. Jordan had to provide a 55-point performance to get him out of game two. Game three came down to the final minute, and I'm not sure, I can't remember how game one was, but I'm pretty sure that was a single-digit victory for the Bulls as well. So they did a good job of challenging Chicago. So the point that I'm trying to make here is these teams that have had to battle their way in, or win their way in, I should say, and really earn their spot, have come in with a bit of momentum. And would it be shocking if one of these teams out of Minnesota or Denver gave a real scare to whoever they played in the first round? I would say it wouldn't surprise me at all, especially when you have the potential. They may not even be the eighth seed in some of these scenarios. They may face off against who knows going to be who's going to be the third seed, but they may end up facing, you know, say Utah in the first round or Portland in the first round. Would it shock you if Denver or Minnesota beat them in the first round? Absolutely not. Wouldn't shock me at least. And that's not even taking into account the context. When you think about Denver very nearly snuck into the playoffs last year. They completely overachieved last year. Nobody predicted that at the start of last season, and they barely missed. A lot of it had to do with Russell Westbrook's incredible performance down the stretch. He ended up hitting that game-winning three. I'm not sure if you guys remember. I think he actually broke the triple-double record in that game, as well as hitting the game-winner. So it was a pretty good way to do it, right? And that essentially ended their season. And they've been consistent this year. And what I mean by that is that we've kind of forgotten about them. We've seen the emergence of Utah. We've seen how the Clippers have battled, but Denver has pretty much flown under the radar all season long. And I was guilty of thinking maybe last year they were a bit of a flash in the pan and we wouldn't see them really compete for a playoff spot in the West. I've been completely wrong again. And quite honestly, if they make the playoffs, do not be surprised, as I said, if they cause an upset, or at least they push whoever they're playing in the first round to the absolute limit. I wouldn't be surprised at all. They're playing great basketball. I like what I see out of them. It's very unselfish. It's very calculated. The intensity is there. And I don't think anybody would have blamed them if they had won 10 less games this season. If anything, that would have been encouraging if they had finished with a record of 35 wins. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying if they finished with 35 wins as opposed to 46 or 47, that would be more encouraging. What I'm saying is, had they had followed up last year with 35 or 36 wins, that would be, we'd still be encouraged by what we've seen and say, okay, they're one player away. Right now, I mean, you say they're less than one player away, maybe just a role player. They'd even need a star player to get them over the hump and become playoff contenders. Absolutely incredible. And on the other side, you look at Minnesota, what Minnesota's really playing for. All the pressure is on them. They're at home. They've got a much deeper team in terms of talent. They've got a quote-unquote better coach, a higher profile coach at least. We'll settle on that because we don't. I mean, if Thibodeau loses this game, when you look at the talent that's on this team and that where they were mid-season for a long time, they were the third seed and then the fourth seed. They have. People talk about how badly Oklahoma has underperformed. Minnesota has trumped them in that. And I know there's been injuries to Jimmy Butler and things like that, but still the talent on this team from obviously Karl Anthony Towns to Wiggins to Gibson to Jeff Teague to Jamal Crawford, there is talent galore on this squad, and there's no way they should be at the eighth seed pretty much fighting for their playoff lives. I'll tell you this, if they lose this game and they get off to a bad start next year, don't be surprised if Thibodeau is axed, because that will be the third year. And if they say 9-13 in the first 22-23 games of the season, I wouldn't surprise me in the absolute slightest if he's fired. There is a lot on the line here for Minnesota. And we'll see exactly what their resolve is. And maybe, just maybe, this is the best thing that could happen to them. Just like it was the best thing that could have happened to Washington in 97 and also Milwaukee in 2000. Maybe they need this test and this challenge, and they have to overcome it before getting into the playoffs. once they survive this, if they do survive it, then will they be intimidated by going into, say, Houston? I don't think they'll be intimidated. They may be overmatched, but I don't think they'll be intimidated. But I think you can tell where I'm going, where I'm coming from here. I am picking Minnesota to win. They are at home. They do have more talent. I think they have a little bit more on the line here. Reputations are on the line here. Jobs are on the line here. If Minnesota doesn't make the playoffs here, don't be surprised. I said that Thibodeau might be fired before the All-Star game or even Christmas of next season, but they may blow up this roster in the off-season. They may trade Wiggins. They may trade Towns. They may completely rebuild. And management would be completely justified in doing so. So Minnesota has a lot to play for here. I think they've got a little bit more to play for than Denver does. And keep in mind, too, that the fan base in Minnesota, they are desperate for a playoff team. They haven't made the playoffs since, I think, Kevin Garnett's MVP season. That's a long time, man. That's a hell of a long time. That might be the longest drought in the NBA. I don't know if it is or not. I haven't looked that up. But it's got to be up there. If it's not the longest drought in the NBA, then it might be the second longest or third longest. Seattle has made the playoffs more recently. And they haven't had a franchise for the last 10 years. That's insane. So I think Minnesota will just get over the line here. But I'm not confident. I'm really not that confident about it. Now we're going to swing over to the Eastern Conference to talk about seedings. I wanted to lead off with Denver and Minnesota because that was a playoff game. But now we're going to talk about some seeding situations. And the first game that I want to talk about is Philly versus Milwaukee. Now, Philly does need to win in order to really preserve that 3 seed. If they lose and then Cleveland beats New York, which I think they will quite handily, if Philly loses, then all of a sudden Cleveland, I believe, will leapfrog them and get the number 3 seed. So it goes without saying that they have a lot to play for. Likewise, the Bucks have a lot to play for too, because they're currently 6. But if they are to lose and Miami is to beat Toronto, and Toronto doesn't have a whole lot to play for right now, they've not only have they secured the number 1 seed in the NBA, but they've got the number 2 overall record. So if they play Golden State in the NBA Finals, they'll have the home court advantage. So they don't have a whole lot to play for, but Milwaukee does have a whole lot to play. Oh, not Milwaukee, sorry, Miami does have a lot to play for. So if Miami wins and the Bucks lose, Miami then leapfrogs them and becomes the 6th seed and will play Philly in the first round. Now, I'm not sure if that's even an advantage considering that Boston is the number 2 seed. Would you rather play Boston without Kyrie Irving and Gordon Hayward, or do you want to play Philly or Cleveland in the first round? I would probably lean towards Boston, but you know, you never know. You want to get momentum. You don't want to be backing into the playoffs. But that's a really interesting one that no one's talking about. Actually, both of those games are the Miami and Toronto one, because Toronto may not have a whole lot to play for, but I don't think they want to lose momentum either going into the playoffs, especially if they're going to be facing a team like Washington, who they've had problems with in the past in the playoffs. Everyone seems to only point to their problems that they've had with Cleveland. Let's not forget that Washington swept them, and Washington didn't have the home court advantage that year. It was 4-5, and everyone thought that Toronto would win that series, but Washington absolutely slapped them around. That was quite hard to watch, actually. It was such a big blowout that it wasn't even competitive. People thought it would be one of the more competitive playoff series in the Eastern Conference that year. But that's when they had Paul Pierce and John Wall. And that was just before John Wall broke his hand. I think if John Wall didn't break his hand, they could have really challenged Cleveland in the conference finals. But anyway, that's a little bit off topic. But the fact remains, Toronto will want to go in with some momentum, considering their playoff demons of years past. I don't think they want to be going in with a pretty big loss to a team like Miami heading into the playoffs. Now we're going to swing over to the Western Conference, and there is so much potential for movement here. That's even worse than the East. Let's start by having a look at the Spurs and Pelicans. And if the Spurs win their game against the Pelicans and Portland loses, San Antonio will actually leap up to number 4, considering the season that they've had And the sabotage, well, you could say self-sabotage that they've had with Kawhi Leonard, and I'm not saying it's Kawhi Leonard that's doing it, but other players and management and coaches, Popovich, they could still get home court advantage in the first round, which is incredible. Now, the Pelicans, on the other hand, if they lose this game, they could drop to the eighth seed when you take into account tiebreakers. So that's, I mean, I'm shaking my head at that. But the thing about that is one of these teams have to lose. And because of that, Oklahoma, if they beat Memphis, they could potentially move up to the number five because they hold the tiebreaker over Utah. So obviously either the Pelicans or Spurs, one of those teams will win and one of those teams will lose. And because of that, if they, of course, if Oklahoma beats Memphis, which they should, they're at home, then they'll leapfrog that team that loses. There's so many scenarios here. I've got to catch a breath, but seriously. The other big game, the other huge game is Portland versus Utah. And I confess this is probably the one I'm looking forward to the most, even more so than the Denver and Minnesota one. And the reason for this is who would have thought? Who would have honestly thought, not even prior to the season, but midway through the season, that this last game of the regular season, Portland and Utah, would determine who is the number three seed in the NBA. Oh, not in the NBA, but essentially in the NBA, though you can make an argument, who's the third best team? It's probably out of the West, right? And that's just incredible. And there's no guarantees, though. And this is why when we're talking about here about teams wanting to move up in positioning and get better because you don't want to face the number four seed or you don't want to face the number three seed. You prefer to face the number five seed or whoever, right? At the end of the day, it really doesn't even matter because the three seed could be Portland. It could be Utah, but you may be facing Portland or Utah still in the first round, but they may be the sixth seed or they may be the fifth seed, but you still got to face them, right? So at the end of the day, a lot of this doesn't really matter, but it's still going to be fun. As for this matchup, maybe some individual awards will be on the line here. And what I mean by this is if Utah wins the three seed, how could you possibly vote for anybody as coach of the year ahead of Snyder if they somehow pull the three seed off? How could you vote for anybody for defensive player of the year apart from Gobert? And then all of a sudden the rookie of the year debate it heats right back up. And quite honestly, it's something that I've given a lot of thought since my last podcast where I said that I'd go with Ben Simmons. But I'll address that in a minute. Here's what I think will happen in terms of playoff seeding once the dust settles. And we'll start with the Eastern Conference. Got Toronto at one, Boston at two. I think Philly wins. Cleveland stays put at number four. Indy can't move any either way, so that doesn't matter. Number six will be Miami. Number seven will be Milwaukee. And number eight will be Washington. In the West, I've got Houston at one. Number two is Golden State. Those two can't move. Utah will get to number three. I think they get a huge road win up in Portland. Number four will be San Antonio. So, yes, I'm picking them to beat New Orleans. Number five will be Portland. Number six will be Oklahoma. Number seven will be New Orleans. Number eight will be Minnesota. So yes, I'm picking Minnesota, as I said before, to beat Denver. So that means, according to my predictions, which means it's going to be totally wrong, and I'm not doing any predictions. I'm not going to go in depth with this. This is just how the playoffs would, the bracket would start in the first round. Toronto versus Washington, that would be gangbusters. Boston versus Milwaukee, also incredible series. Philly versus Miami also would be a lot of fun because of the contrast in style. And Cleveland versus Indy, probably the most boring out of all of those. And in the West, you've got Houston versus Minnesota, Golden State versus New Orleans, Utah versus Oklahoma. Utah would have home court advantage. And San Antonio versus Portland. That'll be very interesting when you take into account the LaMarcus Aldridge factor. That's how I think it'll all play out. But given my track record of making predictions, it's probably going to be the complete opposite to everything I just said. Now we get to talk about Rookie of the Year. And I know I'm fully aware that I chose Ben Simmons over Donovan Mitchell in my last podcast episode. It's not often that I flip-flop that quickly, but I have this time. And there's a couple of reasons why I think Donovan Mitchell deserves to be Rookie of the Year over Ben Simmons. The biggest reason, however, is when you add it all up, okay, yes, Philly was transformed from the trust the process BS to, you know, a legitimate contender to make the finals in the Eastern Conference in 1 year. And Ben Simmons, it's his rookie year. People are instantly going to say, well, he's the biggest reason for that. And you might be right. He is the biggest reason. But then you could also make the argument that Embiid is a more important player to them than what Simmons is. And it's kind of hard to dispute that because Embiid's had a great, great season as well. And the season, a couple of seasons before it, he only played in 20-something games combined, not even per season. He played in, I think it was 22 games over his first 2 years. So not only did they bring in Simmons, but they essentially got Embiid as well. And then on top of that, they've added Ilyasova, they added J.J. Redick, they added Amir Johnson, of course, Markel Fultz, who was the number one pick overall. He didn't really contribute a whole lot, but down the stretch, he's been playing pretty well. Covington, I'm not sure if he was a rookie this year, but he's definitely a young player. He definitely didn't do anything last year that was noteworthy, because I don't remember him playing at all. They also added Marco Bellinelli. The point I'm making is it wasn't just the one addition of Ben Simmons to this roster, and instantly they went from being a perennial contender to get the number one pick in the NBA draft to being a contender to win the entire Eastern Conference. If that was the case, then sure, there's no argument for Donovan Mitchell. There's no argument for anybody really in the history of the NBA, with the exception of maybe five guys, to be Rookie of the Year ahead of Ben Simmons. But let's place a little bit of context to Ben Simmons, and yeah, all the stats and everything, but he has had a lot of help in getting there. Philly is not a one-man team, and that's why they are legitimate contenders to win the Eastern Conference. On the other end of the debate, and you're looking at Donovan Mitchell, and more specifically the Utah Jazz, they lost Gordon Hayward, but they brought in Ricky Rubio, who was essentially off the scrap heap. Minnesota didn't even want him. And they made some trades throughout the season. Obviously, they let Joe Johnson go. They traded Rodney Hood, and they were able to bring in Jay Crowder. But if we're being honest about those moves, at best, from a talent standpoint, they're neither positive or negative. You're trading Rodney Hood for Jay Crowder, for example. From a talent perspective, I'm not sure if Utah even got the better out of that deal. Now, from a fit standpoint, clearly it worked out for him. Now, the point that I wanted to make, though, is despite that, and despite the fact that Gobert has missed nearly 30 games, he's played in 55, they are in a better spot now than they were last year in Hayward, and all they did was replace him with an underachieving, at least at this point of his career, guy that in Ricky Rubio. Donovan Mitchell is the guy that has actually propelled them to become better in spite of that loss. That alone, to me, elevates it. Now, you might say, well, hold on a second, Philly has more wins than what Utah has, and there's no guarantee that Utah will even finish number three. They could finish as low as six. And that's true, but keep in mind, all those teams that I just mentioned, keep in mind the division, for example, that Utah plays in. And when you look at the Northwest Division, Utah and Portland have 48 wins, Oklahoma has 47, Minnesota has 46, Denver has 46. Whoa! Are you kidding? That's insane. Now you look at Philly's division, that's top heavy. You got Toronto, Boston, and of course Philly, but then you have New York and Brooklyn. So there's some easy victories there. The entire Eastern Conference has a lot more easy victories than any team in the West has to deal with. So the fact that they've finished with more wins is irrelevant. The same way that the statistics don't mean a whole lot in this conversation either, because they play vastly different roles. Ben Simmons is essentially playing point guard, and good for him, he's done a great job for doing that, right? But he's got the ball in his hands a lot, so of course he's going to be creating. Mitchell is playing out of position in order to allow Rubio to do what he does best, because Mitchell is, from what I've seen, and I've seen probably about 30, 35 of their games this year, when Rubio is not on the court, Mitchell runs the offense pretty well as a point. You put him in those high pick and roll situations. He is more of a scorer than what Rubio is, but he does distribute the ball too. He still averages 4 assists. And when I'm looking at the numbers, I'm only taking into account when he was a consistent starter. I'm not going to take into account the first 10 games when he started like 2 of those games. So the point that I'm making though is, despite the fact that Simmons has a lot more assists and a lot more rebounding numbers, that doesn't mean a whole lot to me, because that's his role. Whereas Mitchell has found his role, found his niche, found out what he has to do to get this team better, and he has done that in a much harder conference with a team that was much lesser in terms of talent than what they were the year prior. I would vote for Mitchell over Simmons right now. And when I say right now, there's only one game left, so I would vote for him. But I know it's a semi-unpopular opinion, but at the end of the day, I'm looking beyond the hype, and I'm looking, if I've got a team, who would I prefer to have on that team? And you're not wrong if you say Ben Simmons, but I'm also looking that you have to construct a team around Ben Simmons. You don't have to construct a team around Donovan Mitchell in order to make them better. And if you replaced Ben Simmons with Donovan Mitchell in Philly, would they be as good? Maybe not, because it's a different role. But I'm also convinced that if you put Ben Simmons in Utah instead of Mitchell, he wouldn't be able to play the role that Mitchell has played this year. I'm much more confident that Mitchell could fill in the role better, the Ben Simmons role better, than vice versa. And that's why I'm leaning towards him as Rookie of the Year. Anyway, guys, this was really an impromptu podcast, because history is about to be made. It's going to be probably the most exciting final day in NBA regular season history. So enjoy it. I will be doing a playoff preview once I know what the actual seedings and the matchups are going to be. So look forward to that. Take care, guys. I hope you enjoyed the show, and I hope you enjoy the games today.